Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
For example, his tail gunner told me that before every raid, he would find the skipper praying on his knees by his bed in his officer's room. And he would go in and ask him, "Are you praying for our safe return, skipper?" And he'd say, "No, I'm praying for the German people." That's before they went off on a raid.
Firing a gun was the last thing you wanted to do with the traces, giving away your position. And again, finding out these things, I go, I had no idea. That makes absolute sense.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and today I'm joined by my colleague, editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Peter. Good to be here.
Great to have you back. And there's a new aviation podcast that's hit the airwaves, and it is, of course, Never Mind the Dambusters. And we're joined today by the hosts, writer and military historian Jane Gulliford-Lowes. Jane, how are you?
Hello. Very good, thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. And historian and your co-presenter, James Jeffries. James, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It's great to have you both. The podcast has smashed into the aviation sector, been really successful for the early episodes. But before we talk about that and Bomber Command, can you give us a little bit of a background to how you got into aviation and why Bomber Command is so important to you? Shall I come to you first, Jane?
Okay. Right, I first became interested in aviation and military aviation in particular during the Falklands War, believe it or not, when I was a 12-year-old girl. Not the kind of thing that most 12-year-old girls are into, but I was just absolutely blown away by Vulcan bombers and Sea Harriers and Super Eton Dard and Mirage and Exocet missiles and all this kind of thing. And it really, really just planted the seeds of a future interest. But even before then, I'd sort of had a family interest in the subject matter because I had a great uncle, my uncle Jack Clyde, who served in Bomber Command as a wireless operator with 10 Squadron on Halifaxes. And he completed a full tour between 1943 and 1944. And I also had another uncle who served as ground crew on the same base as well. So it was always there in the background, if you like, and it was always going to be an interest that I was going to pursue, I think.
Wow. Okay. Some rich heritage. And James, how did you get into aviation? I think reading a little bit about you, a Battle of Britain featured heavily in your aviation DNA.
It was, yeah. So I've actually got three generations Royal Air Force on my dad's side. And growing up, I couldn't really escape the Royal Air Force, could I? And one of the things to watch was the Battle of Britain, and I was just absolutely mesmerised. It was unlike anything I'd watched before. I wanted to be a Spitfire pilot immediately afterwards. I've watched it hundreds of times now. I know it off by heart, and really, it grew from there, the love of history and aviation. I wanted to know more. I wanted to know what happened afterwards, what happened before. So that was initially more war films, then it became books and documentaries, and then it became studying degrees, and here I am now doing a pod. And Bomber Command, really, it's a continuation of my introduction to the Royal Air Force in the Second World War was the Battle of Britain, and to an extent, the way that we remember RAF Bomber Command, it's the next phase of what happened. And then it's just a rabbit hole, isn't it, Jane? The more you learn, the more you realise you don't know, and it gets you.
Well, I'm going to come back, I think, at some time to ask you about how historians look back on events like World War II. But where does Never Mind the Dambusters come from?
I came up with that name, I must confess, because I just was fed up of watching all these documentaries and listening to all these podcasts, and all they ever talk about is Dam Busters and D-Day and, you know, the Lancaster bomber, if you like. It's what I call the Lancastrification of aviation history. Our view of history seems to be becoming narrower and narrower all the time. And Bomber Command is such a huge subject. And both James and I, you know, discussed this before, and we both felt that there was so much more to be explored than just that famous raid in May 1943.
Okay. Well, we put links to the podcast in our show notes and links in all the social media when this goes out. But let's dig into the topic a bit. And I know you both have particular interests. So, Jane, I want to come to you first and talk about Bomber Command and Mine Lane. I have to get this one out my system a little bit. I've heard you talk about it before, of course, but I knew nothing about this until you surfaced and started highlighting it. Tell us how Bomber Command got involved in Mine Lane, because I always thought that was a coastal command activity.
Okay, so Bomber Command began mine laying in April 1940, and it was one of the longest campaigns of the war. It continued right from that date, right up until the beginning of May 1945. Coastal Command were involved in mine laying at the outset, but from about 1942 onwards, when Arthur Harris took over charge of Bomber Command, Coastal Command's involvement pretty much ceased after that point. But it was a massive part of what Bomber Command did, and it's basically targeting enemy coastal shipping. So we're not talking about battleships out at sea, we are talking mainly merchant vessels, enemy minesweepers, sort of cargo vessels plying the coastal routes, plying the inland waterways and canals. So targeting, if you like, German trade infrastructure. That's what it was all about.
And what sort of aircraft were involved in those activities? Were these aircraft that were diverted from the main Bomber Command tasks?
Well, not really, because they came up with a policy whereby bomber aircraft would undertake mine laying operations when the weather was too bad to bomb Germany, basically. So these poor guys would be going out in all weathers when, you know, the conditions weren't right for bombing, and they would be undertaking mine laying at that point. So that meant that the main bombing effort didn't suffer, if you like, and that the two were pretty much complementary, sort of two sides of the same coin, if you like.
Yeah.
And every sort of aircraft was used.
Yeah.
Every bomber that you can think of was used for mine laying.
And
even swordfish and things like that.
Yes, I read that. But would the swordfish have been, Fleet Air Arm aircraft seconded to Coastal Command?
Yeah, Fleet Air Arm. Yes, that's right.
Right.
Yeah. That was at the sort of in the very early stages of the campaign, yes.
Right. And I believe some of the legacy of that activity was a heavy impact on Bomber Command. Quite a few losses in the activity that affected some of their mainstream activities or their focus in other areas, which to me seems really sad, because as I said, I didn't know about it, and some of those losses feel even greater as a result. Can you tell us about how that affected Bomber Command and its activities?
There were around 486 Bomber Command aircraft lost on mine laying operations.
Wow.
Which absolutely, yeah, is staggering. The loss rate at certain periods, particularly in late 42, early 43, was roughly the same as it was on bombing operations over Germany. There's this sort of misunderstanding that mine laying was perhaps the easier option, and there's all sorts of myths about it, you know, that it didn't count towards a tour and all this sort of thing. That's just completely untrue. It was an extremely dangerous and hazardous activity, because for the vast majority of the time you'd be flying very close to enemy coasts, sometimes even laying mines inside enemy harbors, in places like the Kiel Canal, the Danube. So it was an activity which was absolutely fraught with danger, really. And in terms of the losses impacting Bomber Command generally, I think perhaps they did in the earlier parts of the campaign, but once sort of production of aircraft had been stepped up to such a vast extent, by sort of 44, Bomber Command could absorb those losses, because the losses suffering on mine laying seemed relatively small compared to the losses that were suffering on bomber operations, even though they were proportionately the same.
Yeah, and as you said, they were doing it probably because the weather was poor for some of the heavy bombing that they were doing over enemy territory, and the risks even greater as a result. You know, flying, the cloud was low, you know, they were flying low, they were flying in cloud. The risks must have been phenomenal.
Well, they were. So if you're, you know, undertaking gardening operations, as they were known, say, for example, in Kiel Bay, you've still got to fly over Germany. You've still got to fly all around the coast of Denmark, which is obviously occupied. It's extremely hazardous. And you face exactly the same hazards that you would do if, you know, if you were going on an ordinary bombing raid. You've got coastal defences, anti-aircraft defences. You've got night fighters. And, of course, you've got the most appalling weather as well. So added hazards.
Yeah. James, let me come to you to ask you about another stage early in the war. And that's the term Bomber Command's Battle of Britain, which again was a term that I learned from following you. What was meant by Bomber Command's Battle of Britain?
Well, this was a subject of my MA dissertation. And it came about, as I say, the Battle of Britain was my introduction to history, really, and the Second World War, the Royal Air Force. And my picture of it was really what is genuinely in the British cultural memory, of collective memory of the Battle of Britain. It's about fighter pilots, it's about the few and such like. And I started reading accounts, and some were about Blenheim squadrons, the light bomber squadrons, going over and attacking Luftwaffe airfields. And I thought, hang on, this isn't the Battle of Britain I'm used to, the RAF on the offensive against the Luftwaffe. So I wanted to look at why that memory was, you know, how it changed, how it came to be formed, where it was the fighter pilots and fighter commanders, the dominant memory, and whether that was the case at the time. And when I started looking at the time, that the bomber crews were absolutely part of the few. And you look at Churchill's speech, a huge chunk of it is dedicated to the bomber crews. He singles out the light bombers and the heavy bombers and such like. So that was an absolute rabbit hole I went down with that with my MA. But learning about the attacks on Luftwaffe airfields, that's where I first found out about mine laying as well, about gardening, starting from April 1940. So straight away, and you think that at that time there were 500, 600 aircraft in Bomber Command. They were asked to do mine laying. They were asked to drop leaflets over Germany, to bomb targets in the Ruhr, to attack the ports, to bomb the Luftwaffe airfields. And you're just looking at it and going, oh, my goodness, this is an extraordinary story.
Because they were smashing up the barges as well. I mean, you know, there's a lot being made about, you know, sort of saying, well, you know, the Germans didn't have landing craft in it, et cetera, but they were basically stripping as much sort of barges as they could find and assembling them in a French port, and then you know, Blenheims were going across and wrecking them.
Yeah, they called the ports, especially Boulogne and Calais, the Blackpool Front, because it was absolutely lit up with fires and bombs going off, and some bombers would fly two or three times in a night because it was just over the water, and about 10% of the ships that were assembled, the invasion ships and barges and such like, were sunk. And for me, looking at Bomber Command, I've got people say, oh, they weren't really anything before Paris came along and before they had the Lancaster. I was there, hang on a second, I beg to differ. There's an incredible story here. And like you said, the Battle of the Bulges, there are two Victoria Crosses, one by Bomber Command members in the Battle of Britain linked to the Battle of the Barges. One is Roderick Learoyd, who bombs the Dortmund-Ems Canal. There's a number of it's low flying, it's over water, specially adapted bombs, VC. It sounds almost like another raid that we said we wouldn't mention. But yeah, and they delay the transportation of barges along that canal, which is the main canal that they're coming out of the Ruhr in Germany towards the Channel ports. For 10 days, they block the canal, which I think is extraordinary. And the other VC is one, again, in the Battle of the Barges, John Hannah, youngest RAF VC, still 18 years old, battles wow. fire the fire in his Hampden aircraft with his logbook is badly burnt, but they managed to get back home. And as I say, he gets a VC for it. And these were the stories, and I was talking about the Battle of Britain I wanted to know more about, and I think should be more of the story and the memory that we have of the Battle of Britain.
And you mentioned some aircraft types there, and we sort of forget, we always think of Bomber Command, we, the general public, tends to think of Bomber Command being the Lancasters and the back end of the war. But in the earlier parts of the war, you know, they were flying things like ferry battles and things like that. The task was enormous with the quality of some of the aircraft that they were operating.
Mm. Yeah, and this is the thing. And something else I talk about, the pace of aircraft development from the late 30s into the early 40s is astounding. So an aircraft I've got a soft spot for, which I mentioned in the first episode, the Bristol Blenheim, when it first comes in the late 30s, it's 100 miles an hour faster than the operational RAF fighter, fastest operational fighter, and the RAF snap it up. But within a couple of years, that itself is suddenly incredibly slow and vulnerable to aircraft like the 109 and such. Like it just says so much. And yeah, I think with the commemorations, when it comes to remembering Bomber Command, the Lancaster is prevalent. I think a certain film has something to owe to that. It was my introduction to Bomber Command as a young boy. And also you've got the Battle of Britain Memorial flight with the Lancaster, and it's just taken over.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, actually, the Battle of Britain Memorial flight as a Lancaster in it. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Before we move on to some of the other Bomber Command topics that are probably more prevalent, one of the ones that Tim was talking to me about was electronic warfare and bombers used in the desert. How far was Bomber Command's reach? Because again, popular thinking is that it was Northern Europe, you know, almost single rooted. Can you tell us about some of the other theatres that Bomber Command operated in?
Jane, do you want to go over this?
Well, we've got bomber aircraft operating absolutely all over the place, really. For example, the 10 Squadron that I've done a lot of work on, they were operating out of Palestine in 1942. So they are carrying out bombing raids, in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. Then you've got groups, obviously, in North Africa, the North African campaign. You've got sort of Mediterranean-based groups undertaking bombing and mine laying of and the oil targets in Romania and in the Danube. So they're operating absolutely all over the place. You know, yes, we do tend to think of it very much as the Northwestern European theatre thing, which is obviously where the majority of the effort was concentrated. But they were absolutely all over the place.
And what was it? What was the command structure that managed those quite disparate operations? How were they able? One of the things that we covered in our Coastal Command series was things like innovation and best practice, we would call it in modern language. But how did they share that stuff across such a disparate? Palestine doesn't feel like very far from Europe these days, but it was a heck of a long way then. What was the comms like? How did they share that sort of thing? What was the structure for it?
Do you want to talk about that, James?
The thing that I to remember when it comes to this is it is a combined bomber offensive. So you've got different theatres of command, and you do have different things being learnt. So in the lessons being learnt in tactical air force, for example, the desert is very prominent because it's just where the air force and the troops are actively engaged regularly with the enemy. Same with Northwest Europe. And I think the conversation should be wider and talking about what happens, and not just in Europe, but the Far East and such like as well. It's a similar shared thing. And you mentioned earlier the electronic warfare. I think that's a really, really important aspect that isn't really in discussions. So throughout the war, you've got this battle on its own of scientists going, okay, which way can we battle through and make sure that we hit our targets, and the defenders are going, and this is on both sides, and the defenders are going, okay, how can we stop them? And you see the devastation on the ground and in the air when the different sides have the advantage. So, for example, July 43 with the bombing of Hamburg, the firebombing of Hamburg, a lot of that has got to do with technology such as Window and all these navigational aids coming in. On the flip side, March 43, you have the Nuremberg raid, 30th of March 43, where the bombers are absolutely blasted out of the sky, and you have 96 shot down, over 100 are written off because, you know, and again, circumstances come into it, but definitely the Luftwaffe have the advantage with the technology to detect and shoot down, and they still have the surprise of the upward firing guns, the jazz music, as they call it. I don't know why I went blank then. It's the most obvious thing to remember, isn't it? And I've talked about it so many times. But yeah, it is constantly this other battle that's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah,
It's also the group structure that we should mention as well. Mm. Obviously, Bomber Command is controlled from main Bomber Command headquarters in High Wycombe. But then there are groups which are basically divided up into geographical areas. So, for example, four group that I've done a lot of work on was based in sort of North Yorkshire, South Yorkshire sort of area. Then you've got other groups in Lincoln and Lincolnshire, and then it's sort of further down into East Anglia. So they're all divided up into separate little packages, if you like, all then reporting to Bomber Command headquarters. And that's how the sort of day-to-day control was organised.
So I've got a question here. I mean, we've talked about the different types of aircraft. You know, obviously the start of the war, fairly primitive, rapid expansion into the heavies, which obviously was the kind of plan all along, I suppose, wasn't it? In the 30s, is how can we get bigger, faster bombers with heavier payloads? What's your opinion on the kind of four engine versus Mosquito debate that we had Roland White on the podcast, and obviously talk about Mosquito and whether you could have swapped, you know, Lancasters, Halifaxes, Stirlings, and just built a whole load of more Mosquitoes and you know, won the war that way. What do you think?
I think it's very easy to look at it and go, okay, there's this great aircraft, the Wooden Wonder, the Mosquito and such like, and it comes in and you think, why didn't they swap it? You know, the Lancaster's got 7 crew on it. It's 2 for a Mosquito. It makes sense. It's made out of wood. And then I think, well, actually, the Mosquito, it's only really proving itself sort of end of 42 into 43. And by that point, really, I think the war's turning and you've got a gargantuan amount of resources and effort that have been put into factories and people trained to build these four engine bombers. It's quite a turnaround to go, okay, guys, we're going to scrap this. We're building all these airfields and everything and repair setups and stuff to replace them with Mosquitoes. I think that's the reason why it can't be done. That's my argument against it. On paper, idea, you think, yeah, this makes absolute sense. But if you think of it, what stage of the war this happens, and let's not forget, and I hate saying this because I absolutely love the Bristol Bled in, but when there had been two engined aircraft going over with fighter cover and such like, it hadn't been the greatest of successes. You know, there's still some question and some anxiety about using this. That's my thoughts on it anyway.
It tosses for courses though, isn't it? You know, a Mosquito is not going to be able to drop 6 1,500-pound mines in Kiel Bay like Lancaster can. You know, it's different jobs, if you like. You know, different payloads. I don't think you can could have applied a Mosquito to be used as a sort of general bomb. I don't think it was ever going to be able to replace the role that the Halifaxes and the Lancasters did.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you just sort of touched on there is the kind of infrastructure, the support behind it as well, the air bases and that. And I think there was one amazing stat, which I can't remember, but how many people in the UK economy were involved some way, you know, in World War II in building Lancasters or you know, supporting Lancasters. And one thing I love from the your first pod, actually, Jay, was your little factoid about rubble from Bill blitzed houses used to build bomber bases, which is like, if that's not World War II, kind of the circular sustainable economy, I don't know. I mean, you know, people had, but you know, the bizarre thought of you know, Lancaster bombers or Blenheims or whatever you want, taking off from concrete runways that has got, you know, blitzed houses underneath them. I mean, you know, that's just amazing, incredible.
Yeah, I was totally wowed when I discovered that fact as well. But when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. The amount of materials that you needed to build all of these bases, because you're not just building them for the RAF, obviously, as well. By this time, you're building them for the Americans as well. And all the materials has got to come from somewhere. So why not use, you know, what's available? It's all about, you know, just allocating resources, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, it's quite controversial, isn't it? Because it's destruction, ultimately, of predominantly houses, factories and workplaces. And, of course, you know, the tables go from the bombing of Britain to and as the war turns to the bombing of Germany. And it has been quite a controversial topic, and there are lots of...
Well, rightly so. Yeah, rightly so.
Lots of views. One of the ways of thinking about that is that when the Luftwaffe bombed London, Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, and the key towns in here, it didn't really stop Britain's morale for being up for the fight. Why do you think that those leading bomber command felt that doing the same in reverse to Germany would affect Germany's morale?
Without sounding like Captain Mannering, there was probably an attitude of, well, they're not British, are they? Which I think plays into it. But you think about what happened in the First World War, where you do have the revolution, you do have the German Navy, the mutinies and such like. There's a lot of discussion about this and a genuine belief that actually, yeah, the German people aren't strong enough to take this. Most of them don't really support Hitler and such like. So, yeah, I think there is. And when we look at the magnitude and change of scale that happens over the destruction with bombing, I imagine James, similar to me, that the more I read of it, I still can't get it into my head that the level of destruction and the lives lost in bombing raids, especially as you see them progress during the war.
This is one of the things that we wanted to focus on in the pod as well. One of the reasons why we wanted to do the pod is because we very much want to focus on what it was like at the sharp end of strategic bombing. It's not all just about, you know, fancy aeroplanes and glamorous air crews. It's very much not that. And we really wanted the focus of the pod to be on the magnitude of the operation and what it actually meant for German civilians on the ground. And that's something which we'll intend to cover in a lot of detail on future episodes. You know, that's not something which should be glossed over, as often happens. We need to deal with what it was like. What is the impact? What's it like being in a firestorm? What do 44,000 casualties from the Battle of Hamburg look like? You know, that's something which has to be dealt with, because ultimately that was the aim and that was the end result of the bombing campaign.
Yeah.
Do you think that's now easier now that the veterans are dwindling in numbers, as we can go over that and face the hard truth? Whereas you know, before you're kind of talking to your people, we're you know, putting these kind of questions to, you know, fathers, grandfathers, as what were you doing? What was the effect? I mean, I'm interested also that seemed to the success of your podcast as well shows far from the kind of interest in Bomber Command dwindling away. It's actually, people are now more interested than ever before, which is in a way kind of quite strange. Do you think that's part of it?
I think a lot of people are coming to it because of they want to learn about what their granddad did, who was a ground crew. They want to learn about what their uncle did, who was a navigator, or what their great grandma did, who was a wife on a base. Now, I think there's a whole new generation of people who are coming to it for that reason. But I don't know. It's not something that I've ever shied away from, really. It's certainly in my discussions and my research with veterans, it's something which I've always addressed head on. And I think the veterans that I've spoken to very much sort of understand that and are fully sort of cognizant, obviously, of the results of their actions, if you like. And I think that coming to terms with that has been something which has been very, very difficult for many of them. Yeah. There's a gentleman that I spoke to when I was researching my last book. He wasn't able to talk about it until he reached his early 90s. And it was only by sort of speaking to family members who said, you know, it is okay to discuss this, you know, to explain how you feel about it. And I think it's a very, very nuanced subject as well. For example, the crew that I wrote about, the pilot of the crew struggled greatly with the morality and the sort of conscience regarding the whole bombing campaign. For example, his tail gunner told me that before every raid, he would find the skipper praying on his knees by his bed in his officer's room, and he would go in and ask him, you know, are you praying for our safe return, skipper? And he'd say, no, I'm praying for the German people. That's before they went off on a raid. So it's much more nuanced than I think, you know, we give it credit for. And I think you've really got to approach it with great sensitivity from both sides, you know, acknowledging the horrific sacrifice of the bomber command crews, and also acknowledging the horrific endgame, if you like, for the German people.
Did you know that the RP-3 rocket projectile, used to great effect by Hawker Typhoons in the tank-busting ground attack role, was originally conceived as an air-to-air weapon to attack Luftwaffe bomber streams? Did you also know that in the 1950s, an indigenous light aircraft built in the Philippines was skinned with woven bamboo matting? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McKerrin from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Jane, while we're talking about some of these challenging issues, you wrote a really interesting article about, and I'll quote, the lack of moral fibre and that whole issue about the 10,000 odd aircrew who fell out of the service, for want of a better description. Really, really, really interesting. I mean, my father, who, interestingly enough, didn't talk about his service until he was in his 80s. And we're never sure whether he suffered PTSD from the bombing of London when he was a teenager versus the stuff he did in the Fleet Air Arm. It's a bizarre, bizarre thing. But I now reflect that I think what we know as PTSD started with his childhood, as being 16, pulling people out of burning buildings. Rather than...
It's very much a cumulative thing, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. But I thought it was a really fascinating article because the impact on Bomber Command was massive. And I think the most powerful line I read in those, I think, two articles that you wrote were, they flew until they couldn't fly anymore. And I thought, God, that completely sums up the stress, the pain, the anxiety, the pressure, the terrible things they saw and the terrible things they felt. How do you view this issue and how it impacted Bomber Command and that sort of dynamic of recognizing what we know now versus the challenges, you know, those officers and leaders had of getting bomb crews out to do the tasks they had to do.
I think the issue of lack of moral fibre has been in some ways mythologized. It was a administrative procedure. It's not a medical diagnosis. So if you are you are classified rather than being diagnosed suffering from lack of moral fibre. And it was basically a classification for men who, for whatever reason, just couldn't do it anymore, whether through mental breakdown or whatever. But the problem was that the fear of being labelled as suffering from or being labelled as a person who was lacking in moral fibre, the fear of actually being given that label was almost as great as the fear of having to go out and do these operations in the first place. Nobody wanted to be labelled as a coward. And the whole sort of process took on this mythology, if you like. And so that men were too frightened to admit that they were frightened, you know. And it was just this horrible spiral, if you like, where men were pretty much forced to continue. They weren't able to admit and talk about their feelings, talk about their anxieties. And I've no doubt that many thousands of them were suffering from, you know, some form of psychological condition, whether that be PTSD, whether it be severe anxiety or whatever. I mean, how could they not be? You know, it's just, it's absolutely unthinkable what these men were actually expected to do. And I think it's very, very difficult for us sitting here, you know, 80 years later to try and understand how they must have felt having to go out and do this sort of night after night after night. I mean, if your first two or three operations were horrific, how do you then go on knowing that you've got to do another 27 of those before you complete your tour? How do you keep going? It's just...
And the famous infamous punishment that you kind of hear about sort of, you know, LMF stripped in rank, assigned to cleaning toilets. Did that actually happen? Or there's some discussion as to it was put round by command and basically everyone had heard of some squadron where it had happened, but no one knew exactly the details.
There were certainly one or two incidents where that did happen, I think, but a lot of it was anecdotal, and I think a lot of it was deliberately circulated to ensure that men kept on going. It was, you know, it was the fear of being given that label was probably kept a lot of men flying who shouldn't have been. But what was the alternative? For the RAF, as far as they were concerned, where are they going to get the replacement crews from if these guys all go off sick?
The fascinating thing that I picked up from your article, Jane, was they were the tip of the iceberg. You know, the ones that eventually dropped out of the system were the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's very apparent that there was a large number, we can call it the majority, or we can estimate what it is, but almost all of them, as you said, you know, suffered in some way. And the belief that they went out and did what they had to do with no thought for the implications, to me, just looking back and seeing the evidence now, is I just can't see it.
Of course, there was no sort of psychological support service. You know, there was no counselling back then. You might go and see the CO, but they're more likely to send you off to see, you know, to see the chaplain, to, you know, to have a chat. I know my great uncle's crew were quite unusual for their time, in that they actually used to speak as a crew with each other. They all used to get together and sit and discuss how they were actually feeling about things, which was very, very unusual for the time. And I think it's not something that many crews actually did, but that they said that's what got them through it, being able to discuss it, exactly how they felt with each other.
Yeah. And James, just coming to you for a moment, one of the fascinating things that is about, and I've heard you talk about, is their superstitions. And, you know, we talked about praying there, but to shift the discussion a little bit, can you tell us about some of the interesting superstitions that you came across in some of your research?
Yeah, there'd be all sorts. I mean, you'd have a lucky charm, so it could be a cuddly toy or a pair of your girlfriend's knickers or something. But there's others. So one that's actually circulated quite a lot and seems to have been common. But again, I think it's more commonly held to have happened than actually did, was for the tail gunner to urinate by the tail wheel. Which isn't the best of ideas, thinking about metal and corrosion and such like, but that seems to have been a thing as well. And you wonder about these things. I mean, you think about the odds, and anybody sitting down working out the odds of the chances of coming back, I don't think I would have liked to have done it, but people would have done. You do something on that first mission and you come back, you go, maybe it was that saw me through. Maybe it was because I had a pee before I went on, or I put my left boot on first, or I carried this. It's absolutely human nature to do these things. And sometimes there would be a sense of, it's not going to happen to me. It's going to happen to somebody else.
Yeah.
And I think humor plays a part as well. And you have this sort of dark humor that sees people through. I think that's another factor of survival and such like, and just having that mental carrying on. But yeah, the superstitions, I find them absolutely incredible. And you see it in popular culture as well. You see things where people have St. Christopher's or, yeah.
Yeah, fascinating. And of course, one of the things that does come through looking back and also talking and reading their stories is the camaraderie that they had, particularly as crews, because they could stick together and in effect had, you know, that team ethos to do it together, which drove many of the crews and kept many of the crews together, I think.
This also actually goes with superstition. So if you're a Lancaster and your mid-upper gunner gets a stomach bug the night before an op, he'd be replaced, that would be seen as a bad omen. And the fact that a crew was so tightly knitted, oh God, even though they went through the same training routine and everything, this stranger coming into the aircraft, that's not a good sign. That's not good luck. And a crew would be incredibly tight to the fact that you'd keep as a group. You wouldn't really interact that much with other crews, especially as the war went on, just out of the fact that the chances are they wouldn't come back. Incredibly tightening group. And they had to be. And I think the other thing that I always find, well, I found extraordinary when I first listened to it, was some footage of a crew talking over the radio, and they're attacked by an enemy fighter. I don't know if people have heard this. And they're so incredibly calm. And I'm there going, hang on a minute. You're just, and then I think, no, you have to be, you have to say it in a calm way. And if the rear gunner says corkscrew left, skipper, you know, dodge, he does it. He doesn't hesitate. And again, another thing is, this is what I mean by the rabbit holes that you constantly go down, is gunners generally didn't fire their guns. They were there to shout, there's an enemy fighter on our tail, dodge it. Firing a gun was the last thing you wanted to do with the traces, giving away your position. And again, finding out these things, I go, I had no idea. That makes absolute sense. I'd think, oh, yeah, the thing you want to do is blast away and hope they go away. And it's like, no, that's the worst thing you can do.
So I've got a question here on for both of you. We've obviously had a bombing campaign of a slightly different version or daytime in the media recently, with the recent Masters of the Air from the US perspective. So just for a question for both of you, and obviously we've been dancing around the squadron that cannot be named, but Bomber Command in media, films, TV, games, you know, what are your thoughts on that? What's your favorite Bomber Command movies or favorite Bomber Command games or TV books? Led Dice must be in there somewhere.
My favourite of favourites, yeah, absolutely. Bomber, Len Dayton, I think is wonderful. The book, yeah, it's not without fault. There are mistakes. And one of them is actually the way that LMF is tackled in it, and it's certainly what happens at the end of the book. I won't say any spoilers, just in case someone isn't aware of it. And yeah, there's a radio adaptation done in 1995, and I think it's excellent because it tells multiple perspectives. It tells the suffering on the ground. It also doesn't shy from the fact that there were Nazis there as well. And it talks about shortcomings in the Royal Air Force. It addresses the sense of fear, of camaraderie, of experience, inexperience. And the moral aspect is very prevalent when it comes to the story. I think that's my absolute favorite. And I also, to jump into films, I'd say The Way to the Stars I'm a big fan of. If people are aware of that, it tells the story of an airfield that is initially RAF and then it goes to the United States Army Air Force. So it goes from Blenheims to Bostons and B-17s. And I love it. It's made during the war, written by Terence Rattigan, who was in the RAF, wrote the play Flare Path. And I just love the dialogue and the fact it starts looking at dealing with loss and coming to terms with the war as well. I think there's some beautiful, and it's full of humor and sadness and this comedy tragedy. I'm coming out as the ex-drama student here, aren't I? I think that the balance and play there is absolutely beautiful. So they're definitely two of my favorites. Yeah.
Jane, what about you?
Well, I have to say that movie, The Dam Busters, is still in my top three movies of all time. I have very fond memories of watching that film with my grandparents when I was a small child, and my grandmother pointing out the role of the wireless operator, saying, "You know, that's what your uncle did. That's what Uncle Jack did." And I've always loved that film. I think my other favourite is Appointment in London with Dirk Bogarde. It's such a in some ways understated, and it just never gets mentioned. And it's such a fine observation, I think, of the pressures that the bomber crews faced and about the camaraderie and everything else. It's just really beautifully observed, I think. And the sort of the final battle scene is very, very well done for the time as well. I absolutely love that. I also want to mention a play that I saw recently, the last few years or so, at the Edinburgh Festival, called Wireless Operator. It's a one-man show, sort of a very modern adaptation, if you like, but it is absolutely superb, and I think there are moves afoot to have a film version made of that shortly, and it's highly recommended to whoever gets the chance to see it. It's very,
wow.
Very good.
Yeah.
And of course, there was the Lancaster documentary that came out a couple of years ago. And I mean, you know, the one thing that, you know, interests me about the film that cannot be named, let's mine the Dam Busters, is its influence on popular culture, you know, on Star Wars. Because there was one of the cinematographers who was actually flying, you know, in the RAF, you know, documentary unit in there, and you know, start from Star Wars to, I mean, even Top Gun Maverick has got a, you know, it's got a canyon scene, it's got a difficult target, you know, it hasn't got the flak towers, but it's got SAMs, you know, so everything there is in place, so it still kind of percolates through our popular culture somehow.
There was a video on YouTube of matching up the attack on the Death Star and the attack on the Mariner Dam.
Yes.
And how much they match up, which I had never made a connection with until I watched it and went, oh my goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
Even some of the lines are the same, aren't they? It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing also, a question as well, if I can, is, I mean, we started off by talking about how primitive the RAF technology were, how primitive the bombers were, your battles, your Blenheims, and the fact, obviously, you know, we had to go through the horrendous tactic of area bombing, dehousing, because that's the only thing that was the only target we were going to hit. But by the end of the war, again, the squadron that cannot be named. Precision daylight bombing with tall boys and being able to hit viaducts, you know, from these great, you know, railway lines and tunnels and things like that. So there is a sort of like a this progress in technology, isn't there, from you know, the kind of ambitions and the sort of like the dreams that this is what you'd be able to do. To by the end of the war, you are able to do it. You are able to go, I want that bridge removed, and you know, somebody will go with a Lancaster and a massive earthquake bomb and remove it, and sort of surgically remove it in a way.
Yeah, and I mean, it helps having the Luftwaffe sort of not there as well by the end of the war.
The
technology is astounding. So at the start of the war, they're going by dead reckoning. That, you know, they're going by the stars. They're looking at the canals and streams and going to a map and going, yeah, that kind of looks like it, and doing the calculations, to things like H2S and the navigational aids you have there, G. There's a slow progression. But it's, when you think about it, it's actually remarkably quick, and it just shows how much effort was put into improving this technology.
I think even with regard to mine laying that we were talking about before, by mid-44, you can drop a mine in someone's harbour from 15,000 feet, so you're no longer having to do it from 500 feet, which is what you were having to do at the beginning of the war. And just that change in just, what, 4 or 5 years is absolutely incredible.
And does the modern equivalent military strategist, have they learned from that? We talked about the Falklands as well as learning points. How are the lessons from what Bomber Command achieved in World War II filtering through into modern military strategy, do you think? If at all? I mean, we see drones, we see cruise missiles, all sorts of autonomous, I don't even know what to call them now, all sorts of autonomous things. Is what was achieved by Bomber Command in World War II the platform for those strategies?
I think the end result, yes. But in terms of the technology are so vastly different now that I think it's very, very difficult to equate the two or really, you know, to conduct comparisons. What I would say is that the Americans have come back to mine laying in the last 10 years or so as a sort of, both as a defensive and a offensive strategy for targeting enemy shipping.
Yeah, interesting.
And it made me laugh. I was reading an article by a US Air Force colonel. I think it was written in 2016, and he was raving about the capability that mine laying provided them with, and it was like reading stuff that I've read, you know, from 1942. You know, things come full circle again. And even, you know, the modern day YNZ, their descent into the water is still slowed by parachutes. So yes, you can launch your mine from 35 miles away and have it precision guided, you know, to a square foot of sea, if you like. But the basic principles and the basic ideas behind what you are trying to achieve is the same. So in some respects that there are parallels, but with regard to bombing generally, I think it's very, very difficult to draw too many similarities or conclusions, because the technology has moved on so much.
I'd agree with you on the renewed interest in mine laying from the US perspective. I mean, they're looking at Asia Pacific, and I think the thing is, it's not sexy. It's not you know, you're not firing a missile off. You know, you're doing something that's, say, I mean, you know, the code word gardening kind of sort of sums it up, doesn't it? It's like, oh well, you're not, you know, you're dropping the.
But it
you
works.
You don't see the results. You don't see the immediate results of what that mine might do. But what I do think is interesting is there, and you addressed it on your podcast as well, is the fear of the bomber, but also, We can do this by not having slaughter on the front lines. We can go directly to attack the enemy's center of gravity, and I think there is an element of that in some of the doctrine that is coming out, like cyber space. You know, you crash an enemy country's banks or get rid of their cash points and things like that. Oh yeah. If you did that, you wouldn't have to fight. Everybody give up. You know, or you can put sanctions on their economy and they'd give up. And it's like, okay, you know, is that are we going down the same route now where you know, you maybe unleash, you know, cyber warfare or AI or something, and everyone goes, oh yeah, you know, this is definitely going to make for a bloodless war. But then
you look at what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah. So you know, the idea of going
policy
around
and again, strategy is very different in practice, isn't it, to what actually is achieved in reality.
So bringing us full circle then back to the podcast, without giving too much away, what exciting plans have you got for episodes coming up? Because we've just touched the tip of the tiniest point of the iceberg, so you folks must have some monumentous content coming up. Can you share anything, or are there any particular thematics you're going to look at?
I'm worried I'm going to say too much and get told off by Jane, so I'm going to let her lead
Jane lead us.
Because I get far too excited. I'd think, oh my God,
we've got some really, really great stuff coming up. Our next episode, which is out very, very shortly, we're looking at the work of ground crews and ground personnel and WAFs, because nobody ever talks about that.
Yeah.
So we've got Dr. Dan Ellen from the University of Lincoln to talk about that. And that's a really, really good episode. Then in the one after that, we are then going to be looking at my favourite aircraft, which is the Handley Page Halifax. And we've got some really, really excellent content for that, which I'm not going to give too much away, but that's going to be an absolute corker of an episode. Yeah.
Oh, great, great stuff.
But there's just so much. It's just such a massive amount of stuff out there to talk about. So.
And so great that you're bringing it to us. So where can we find the podcast? Where can we find it online, and what should people look for?
If you search for Nevermind the Dam Busters, wherever you get your podcasts, you should be able to find it. It's on all the usual platforms and providers. Instagram, same title. Twitter, same title. You'll find us there. Well, we'll be sharing photographs and videos and stuff as well. So, yeah, just Google Nevermind the Dam Busters and you will find us.
And Jane, where can we follow you on social media?
I'm on Twitter at, or X as it now is, of course, at Lydia Jane 13, my full title.
And James, how about yourself?
So I'm on Twitter and X. I still call it Twitter. So I am at all lowercase James J History, and I'm on Instagram James J History as well.
And just a note to listeners: they're great to follow. Good pictures, and I love your logo, by the way. The podcast logo is great.
Thank you.
So really enjoying it. Listen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks.
Been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been great. Thank you very much.
That's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian. Of course, Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club for all his support as well. Tim, where can we find you online?
Yeah, I'm still on at RESTimR, and we are on, you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society at www.aerosociety.com.
Thank you. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter X. And you can find Ellie and Gareth on the extended Twitter X, Facebook, Threads and Instagram feeds. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
It's goodbye from Jane.
Goodbye, everyone. Thank you.
And it's goodbye from James.
Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for listening.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
from across the globe, from the centre of aerospace. And now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.